can do that. Sorry, I missed the first 10 minutes. Okay? Anyway, back to this. Because of what we're going to be doing, I am currently leaning towards having no midterm and final. We will have two projects, or one may be a continuation of the other. Last year, we worked with such projects as deskewing of documents, eigenfaces. I don't know if any of you have seen eigenface work. It's sort of rather cool. What basically does I won't quite say average, but what does a face look like? And we'll talk about elements, very specific elements in linear algebra, which are going to be relevant to image analysis. Now, if you really would prefer a midterm and a final, let me know, and I'll reconsider that. But I like the projects. Now, I've been working on this, and what we're doing, for those of you who have looked at the last time we offered the course, I'm compressing the classic image processing stuff to the first half of the semester. And this is all of your spatial filtering, that is, and by that I mean filtering in the space domain, x and y coordinates. And we will talk about image representation shortly. We'll also come back and look at that in the frequency domain. We'll talk about space-time relationships, low-pass, high-pass filters. It turns out, though, we go well beyond that because there are so many filters in image processing that don't necessarily have an analog in conventional time domain image signal processing. Now, here's where things start to get interesting. We're going to start with image degradation, inverse filters, and optimal filters. I don't know if the names Wiener and Kalman mean anything to you. Do any of you have backgrounds in Wiener or Kalman filtering? A couple. Good. You may want those people on your projects. Okay. Because one of the things that we're going to be really, really interested in is estimating things. And that's where optimal filters are great. We're going to be getting into geometric transforms, image registration, warping. This gets into the whole idea of geometric distortion of images. And we're going to find out right after fall break, I plan on talking about geometric optics, camera calibration, basically how do we model and create images. And it turns out it's almost inherent in our image acquisition that we will have distortion of the images. And that's going to be directly related to sensing and measurement. A big thing, which I've always been interested in, and it's gotten more and more importance recently, is color image processing. This is especially significant when you're dealing with things like grass, asphalt, vegetation, etc. It has a tremendous amount of other applications, but color image segmentation is of great value to mobile robotic navigation. In fact, with the original CMU NavLab stuff, it was really pretty neat. This was back when they had it on the Ford, or was it a Chevy? I can't remember. The three-quarter ton truck that had the seven sun stations in the back of it. And it would drive along the campus, and it was really pretty cool. They had a graduate assistant that would walk along behind it, and he had a pull cord. And the idea was, as soon as that vehicle, with all of their expensive computer equipment, because their laser scanner alone, even back then, was a quarter to half a million, okay, if that truck went into a ditch, it was a really bad problem, okay, and a very expensive one. Even CMU couldn't afford to replace that kind of stuff quickly. So they had this graduate student protecting it. What was the problem? Very conventional one. You're following the edge of asphalt. Gray, green. Should be very easy. Okay? What's the problem? Sun, tree, or shrubbery, shadow. Follow edge, right into ditch. Not a good situation. So you have to deal with more than just color. And one of the things that we will get into, which I'm really, really interested in, is always three-dimensional images LIDAR images, what we call range images, and I'll talk about those. We'll do a little bit with morphological image processing because it's a very simple technique for cleaning up images and doing things that you couldn't do any other way. It's actually based on set theory, and it's just a completely different way of looking at filtering. It's all in the space domain. Segmentation is the kind of stuff we're really, really interested in. If, for example, I'm in a mobile robot and looking at the road ahead, I would like to segment the road, know where it is, and be able to predict and follow it. And by the way, that's where our optimal filters stuff comes in. If you are in biomedical image processing, you know, you might want to, for example, segment an organ like a kidney or liver from the different texture of the rest of the body. There are all kinds of reasons why you want to use segmentation. One thing that is often used in segmentation, we will not, I suspect, use it in here, is texture. That could be vegetation. That could be repetitive patterns within a segment of the image. And I'll show you examples of that later. But we will look at different ways of representing images and manipulating them. The two most common ways are edge-based representation and region-based representation. And it turns out if you get into graph theory and stuff, these are very highly related to each other. Okay? But the idea is, as I look at the class, I can represent you, for example, the colors of your shirts, the color of the wall. Those are properties of a region, and that's a region. The other thing which I can do is I can actually say, oh, I have a discontinuity in color. We go from yellow to black, for example. That's a color edge. And so I can base my knowledge on edges. Okay? These are highly related to useful images. We can do it using other things, as we will learn down here. We can actually use motion, for example, to segment images. Okay? Stereo imaging, stereo matching, shape from. This sounds really cool, like it's a science fiction concept, but it shape from X just simply means that we can take all kinds of properties of the image and use that sometimes in just a purely mathematical sense, two-dimensional differential equations with boundary conditions, or it could be inferential. But for example, we take a light source and illuminate something. I know an awful lot about the lighting. I know an awful lot about reflectance, etc. And based upon the actual intensity I observe with a camera, I can tell you, or at least I can make a good estimate, as to what the surface point that's involved in action is. And I can then the entire three-dimensional structures. And that's all of this shit from. I put it here out for I may move it up a little bit earlier. We'll worry about that later. Image flow, segmentation, motion tracking, and I like to play semester with actually some of the coolest stuff that we get into, which is actually reasoning about images. We get pattern recognition, etc. An awful lot of this part of the course is taking an ordinary two-dimensional picture and turning it into a symbolic representation that we can reason about and manipulate. It also turns out, if you take an AI course, people will tell you that image compression is nothing more than a form of artificial intelligence. It's reducing the information needed to describe an image. And that's the kind of thing we would like to do for a variety of applications. And I think that's the basic stuff about the course. Any quick questions on that? No? Okay. Let me give you an overview of image processing. And let me see if this works right. Okay. I'm going to give you an overview, probably about 50 or 60 slides of image processing. It won't be so aimed towards mobile robotics or anything, but general image processing. And I'm coming from three different primary references. Our textbook, which I really like. This is an old classic, Ballard and Brown. They're out of computer science at Rochester. This was one of the very first computer vision books, and is one of the most clearly written and easy to understand. A couple chapters of it are online on my website. It is out of print. And actually, this is a typo right here. This is actually two references jumbled together. Bertram Horn wrote the book Robot Vision. He's in the media lab at MIT. And Kelly is actually a person who did a lot of work with simple image processing for the purpose of robot grasping, pose estimation. For example, if I want to reach out and pick up an eraser or something, that's a three-dimensional object. I need to know its size, orientation. We get into the pose for those of you who have taken robotics. And I need to know that information to pick it up and grasp it. Okay. Now. Uh-oh. Anyone see my cursor? Ah, there we go. I'm not sure exactly what happened. Whoops. Okay, this is actually a historical one. It turns out that people were doing image processing a long, long, long time ago. This is a World War I image. We're talking in like the 1915, 16, 17 time frame. It turns out that pictures were originally digitized and sent using teletype equipment. And it was pretty interesting. Instead of using modern fax equipment, they used two techniques. One is, and I don't know if any of you remember this kind of really early 8-bit computing type image printing, where you would print various characters on top of each other on the printing to give you on the printer to give you various shades of gray. Okay? That's one technique which people did with teletype machines. But this is actually even older and cooler. They used little spark plugs. And the idea is they had a special paper, and as you moved along, they'd fire the spark plug and burn the paper. So this is these original, that's why it looks so contrasty, almost black and white. It's because that's where it's burnt, and that's where it isn't. So all kinds of cool early technology. Now, an awful, awful lot of modern image processing came out of two major research activities. The first is NASA. All of the planetary flybys, and there still is a tremendous amount of image processing. This is probably Jupiter. Now, where did all of the other major interest in image processing come from? Well, this is sort of interesting. This is an aerial view. This could also be a satellite view. And it turns out an awful lot of early image processing came out of the intelligence community. Okay, in all kinds of flavors. This is actually showing a very cool application where what they did is they took a color. Well, actually, this one's pseudo-color, and we'll talk about that distinction later. But they took an aerial image, and this is known as image registration. They took a map. If you have reference marks between the two, you can actually warp one or geometrically modify one to lay it on top of the other. Okay, and so this is putting a map with roads and political boundaries on top of a purely physical image. And they use pseudo-color to show different regions. For example, this might be grass, which has a different infrared reflectance than trees. And it's amazing. By looking at the stuff in different wavelengths, you can really do an awful lot of characterization. You can do processing. And this is something you'll learn in about 3 weeks. This is an original image. This is probably a satellite image. And what we've done, and this is simply a Laplacian filter, it turns out that what it is it's a derivative operator which emphasizes edges or changes in the image. And you can see how it sharpens everything up. Some of this might be done by a sharpen filter in things like Photoshop and stuff. You have to look carefully, though, at how they do it. This is actually sort of interesting. This is just an ordinary overhead image. But what's really interesting over here is this is an aircraft on sand. But what's intriguing is if you look at it in a near-infrared band, you can see that the sand here is a different color. And so aerially, we can tell that it's been disturbed. And you can tell that this aircraft was moved in and out and sort of make some estimates of when. So all kinds of interesting things. This is more my type of background. In this, and you can't see it very well, but right there, what we're doing is we're projecting a laser stripe. Okay? And we're taking an image of that laser stripe. And by knowing where the source is and where the camera is, we apply triangulation principles, and we can actually come up with x, y, z coordinates for every point along that line. And this is used oftentimes for high-precision inspection of complex machine surfaces. For example, you can do about a 1/10th of an inch. And these people take this stuff really seriously. For example, I was at a conference where they were discussing the techniques. If I shine light on an object and it's going from black to white, in other words, it's reflecting and it isn't, okay? And this gets into the physics a little bit, but it turns out that the actual accurate position of the edge is displaced by backscattering. That is, dust particles in the air, okay, are actually making this side brighter than it should be, and it slightly displaces the location of the edge. So they will fit things like polynomials to that and actually estimate where the edge is, including light scattering effects. So you can do really, really precise things. Obviously, you can use this with robots and manufacturing and all of that kind of stuff, and that's a fairly common thing. In fact, for those of you who have access down on the second floor of Glennon, and you've seen all of that old flexible manufacturing work cell, or maybe some of you work for companies where you are doing machine vision inspection of parts. Very, very common. That type of vision processing tends to be more binary. It tends to be more higher speed. Oftentimes, it's just measuring the size or position of something very specific. And it's usually designed for high speed. Mobile robots with vision. Great. This is actually an old one that I got. I just got a kick out of it. This is actually a six-legged robot designed to run around in nuclear reactors. Okay. It was one of the very early ones. Okay. And it's wire controlled. And it's got one camera up here in the arm. And by the way, it's got that weird thing because that weird set of legs because it was one of the first that was able to go up and down stairs in a very narrow environment because the stairs in some of these nuclear reactors aren't very big. Now, I'll put in this one. We're really interested in robotic vehicles. And you'll hear the name ENSCO come up quite a bit during this semester. This is actually a car that was used, actually a Honda Element, so I guess it would be more of an SUV, that was used by Team ENSCO in the last DARPA Grand Challenge. Wasn't used in the challenge? I know it was their data acquisition. Oh, and this is just recent. Okay, but this is sort of pretty cool. This is a vehicle showing various sensors, and the whole idea is this is now going around collecting data from all kinds of sensors so that it can eventually learn to drive autonomously in an environment. streets, traffic signs, intersections, all kinds of cool things. And correct me if I'm wrong, this is probably a rotating laser rangefinder up here. I suspect this is a GPS antenna here. These are probably two low, simple laser ranging sensors. This is probably a color camera right here. Yes? No? Stereo? Okay. It's a little narrow for stereo, but okay. And I'm not sure what's down here. Another LiDAR. Basically, when you get into all of this mobile robot stuff, and if you're taking 591, if you're taking 484, you'll have more discussion of this. You get into creating a local reference system so that you know where objects are. And this is particularly important if you're passing cars, parking. And we'll talk about some of the projects, but we're going to be very interested in projects which can apply to mobile robotics in this type of situation. And that means we'll especially be emphasizing three-dimensional vision and related things. Now, any biomeds in here? No? Okay. But one of the other big driving forces for image processing is biomedical imaging. This is actually a CAT scan. I don't know if anyone here remembers Technicare. Anyone in here ever hear of that name? Okay, you're an old Clevelander probably.
I work for somebody.
Oh, okay. Well, it turns out all of the biomedical imaging stuff actually started here in Cleveland, and Technicare was one of the very, very first companies. This is a CT scan. We won't get into the mathematics or the physics of CT, but the basic idea is sort of a shadow photography system where you take a body and what you're going to do is illuminate it with radiation from a couple different sources. What you will get is an image that's projected onto a sensor plane. And if you take enough of these, which is usually 3 to 6, what you can actually do is invert that problem mathematically and tell you what the density of every little XYZ coordinate inside that box is. And it doesn't have to be used for medical. There's lots of applications in all of them. Okay, I'm going to take us on colorization. For many people who feel very passionate about this, I don't remember which movie this is, but it's fairly famous. But yes, it was a big thing a couple years ago, actually probably more like 10 years ago, developing automated techniques for from one frame to the next proper color insertion. And it usually had to be hand-guided, because when you would cut from one scene to another, the operator would usually have to go in and hand-color. But what it would do is would fill in between all the breaks and track the regions properly. Computer-enhanced images. And actually, one of them is really, really useful, and it turns out it's that one. This right here is just a simple lunar landscape that what we've done is we've run a edge operator on it and sharpened it up. This doesn't show it very well. We'll have much better examples later. This one, it gets into just the perception. It turns out if you look at images on things like monitors, etc., oftentimes they don't have enough dynamic range or the what we would call the black and the white level aren't properly set that you can see all the details. And in this case, we do something called histogram equalization. Just make it show the total possible dynamic range of the image. And you can bring out what is the case. Now, this is more on the perceptual human computer interface side. If your image processing, this isn't nearly as important, although there is a major problem in a potential outdoor environment. the sun. The dynamic, I mean, the light levels change considerably, and we will talk about dynamic range as a limitation of sensors. This one is actually a really interesting, I have to tell you what's wrong with this one. This was simply a camera that was moving at a constant velocity. And if you know what the constant velocity is, it turns out that it's actually very easy to go in and de-smear it and clean it up. So that's motion compensation. And we'll talk about all of these. This one's on my door, okay? And with Bill here, he actually, he is very intimately familiar with this. This was actually, of course, a spoof on the web. It turns out this was actually a processing competition. I don't remember who actually did it. Norway. One of the Scandinavian countries. All of this, I'm not quite sure. What is this, 637? Particularly nice with the steering wheel here. You know, in a treatise, it says that this is how scientists of the 1950s envisioned that a computer would look like, I think, in the year 2000 or something. Okay. But I thought it was really cool to have the steering wheel. For those of you who are as old as I am, you recognize things similar to an LA-120 teletype old incorporated stuff. Of course, the computer monitor on the wall, you know, it's not plasma or anything like that. This is an old-fashioned TV. And this guy right here, according to the blurb on the web, if you go and search it, he's actually a farm supply salesman from Western Ohio. I don't know how they picked him, but he really looks like a nice gentleman. And the kind of thing that you want to look at here, and this is where you get into image processing, what you want to do is look at whether seams and artifacts are done here. All of this is an example of things that come from the spatial imaging domain. Okay? We've been very, very careful here. If you look at the standard, a good example of image processing is to watch your weather people on television, and you're in front of a green screen, and they do the chroma keying, and you see fuzzy edges. This is done very well. So, and it's also clever. Now, image processing, this is a little old, but I kept this image in here. We're going to be looking at something. Fundamental system. We're going to have a computer in it. These days, we don't have operator consoles, although I have to admit, I love the old computers where I was able to watch the registers at all times. That's when you really knew what was going on. Displays and mass storage. And by the way, it's really interesting. These days, imaging is really driving mass storage. I felt so good about 2 weeks ago. I got two of the brand new IBM 750 gigabyte vertical head drives, and now I have 1.5 terabytes in my system at home. All rated, of course. Can't lose things. But apparently, photography is really driving things. Most photographers these days have 2 to 5 terabytes on their system. And of course, you need a couple gig of RAM. These are rather large. That's an old-fashioned, dedicated image processing system. I remember starting out on my original Silicon Graphics system, and I still am very fond of those. They had beautiful displays, although these days their stock is selling for next to nothing. Often, you're going to see specialized hardware, and this was really, really big throughout the 70s, 80s, and still now. It's not uncommon to find specialized image processing hardware, and you've often seen it in anything that's designed for multimedia. Very fast, usually DSP-type hardware, although most images are going to actually be 8-bit, and we'll talk about that. There are limitations in that. Is anyone in here really familiar with things like RAW, 32-bit TIFF, and stuff like that? Okay. I'm a big fan of those. even though you get huge files. Okay, but don't be surprised if you see vision processing boards, special chips, all kinds of stuff. We should never forget that one of the things is that we are dealing with humans. Humans are the basis, well, that's why we have so much focus on vision. And the eye is a very simple system. I shouldn't say that. Slap me. The eye is a hugely complicated system. There are unbelievable numbers of sensors out here. There are sensors which turn on other sensors. It is very, very complicated. I'm going to take a very simple-minded viewpoint, and it breaks it down to a simple imaging system, which we call a pinhole camera. We can go beyond the pinhole camera approach, but we view the lens as a very simple lens. And what the pinhole means, and I don't know if any of you ever took the old box, you know, the cardboard box, and took a pencil or nail and poked a very, very tiny hole in it. And if you would somehow stick your head in and look at the back plane of the box, you would actually see an inverted image formed under the right conditions. And the right conditions were that it satisfied the lens law and all of that. And that's what's going on here. In most cases we will deal with, we have a simple lens, we're going to be looking at an object, we'll have straight lines, optical rays, which will all pass through the same point. This is our lens. And we'll create an inverted image on the back surface. And most optics will create an inverted image. There are, as we get into compound lenses, that's not actually true. But a lot of stuff does. And for those of you who are really, really into biology, there's just so many cool things that go on in here, including built-in signal processing. One could work on that for decades, I think, and have a lot of fun. We will be talking about some of the models for image formation. This is actually getting into radiometry, and I'm not going to touch on that very much in here, because one of the things that we do, aside from the simple idea of a lens and all the rays passing through the same point, we look at a small area. Actually, let's take a look at a small area on the object out here. We illuminate it with light from a source. And in this case, we're going to, it could be the sun, but in this type of system, we often want to control the light. And the reason for doing that is, if we take a small area here, it turns out light obeys things like Snell's law. We have the optic, but we have the angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection. We'll talk about the physics in that lecture about fall break. But basically, we obey the laws of reflection. But what you can get into is, what's the relationship between the size of this area here, the size of this area here, this surface normal here, and also, it turns out, the reflectance properties of this surface. And it's a complicated problem. But knowing the brightness here and that type of surface, I can tell you exactly how bright this will be out here. And it's a function of this normal. And that's how I can do this shape from shading. By measuring the grayscale out here, I come up with a table of possible surface normals. And then I can do that for every little area element on that surface and work backwards. There's geometric camera models. I used to include these in 489 when I taught it. And it turns out, for those of you who took 489, I'm going to say those wonderful words, homogeneous coordinates. And we will use homogeneous coordinates to represent all kinds of cool things. Remember when you did the homogeneous coordinates, and I can't remember if you used the last row or the last column. Okay, but it turns out when we get into, you used it for just XYZ translation, but it turns out we're going to use the other set, and we're going to use them for things like warping, scaling, and image distortion. Okay, they're there, and we can use them. Oh, in fact, there they are. It turns out, by the way, computer vision people do it in exactly the opposite relationship to robotics people. Okay? But we'll put in perspective transforms and scaling. The standard rotation and position you've seen from a robotics course. And don't worry, we're not going to spend a lot of time on that. Computer image representation. I've spent all of this time, and I've not told you how an image gets represented. Typically, an image gets represented as a two-dimensional matrix. By the way, that's not always true. There are three-dimensional things, and when we get into motion sequences, there are also other ways to represent things. But this is the most common to talk about, a simple image. Historically, image processing people put the origin in the upper left-hand corner. I'm not exactly sure why. I really don't know. Anyone know who the earliest, well, actually, I don't want to get back into, you know, cavemen or anything like that. But the earliest person who really worked with computers was probably Roberts at MIT. And to put things in perspective, he was using a television camera that had tubes in it, okay? And he used an IBM 7094. Has anyone ever heard of that machine? By the way, it used vacuum tubes. It was very small, and he did the first computer interfacing experiments way back in the 70s and earlier. I think actually it was in the 60s. And he probably was the one who put the origin up here and everyone copied it. But this is standard nomenclature. Usually you number from 0 to n minus 1. That's not always true. Sometimes I've seen it 1 to n. And this shows it as square, but it's often rectangular. And we will represent some function, f of x, y, at each spatial coordinate in the x and the y direction. Now, in this particular case, f will be the intensity, or what we would call the grayscale. It's a measure of the light that we measured at that location. And each of these, in reality, is usually a little area, although mathematically, we'll model it as a point, because that makes all of our Fourier transforms and everything much, much simpler. But if you look at a commercial camera sensor, this will be a physical area, and you'll have an average intensity over that area. Okay. In fact, maybe I'll tell you about subpixel interpolation, which was a neat technique that NASA developed for star tracking on early spacecraft. Image representation. This is usually the scheme that we go from 0, which is black, 0 meaning lack of anything, 255 to your whitest level. Now, this is implicitly, because of the way I did it here, 8 bits at each element. And this effectively really shows the nature, the area nature of each element of the picture. Remember earlier I just said f of x, y. What we're really doing is we take an average, or actually I should probably better say an integrated value over each pixel. And so for example, if you look here, we've got real high values for white in here corresponding to the ball that's being grasped. And notice what you see when you're on the edges. The gray levels change and they're going down, and this is supposed to be a darker area. I'm sorry, it's not black, okay? It's a gray, okay? And that's why it doesn't go all the way down to 0. But you can see the effects that happen here, and you can almost see in your mind, okay? If I fit a curve to that, I could very precisely estimate where the edge is. And that's possible if you know enough about the illumination level and stuff. Depending on how much resolution you have, this is what an image might look like. And here we're showing it as gray, okay? And you can see, for example, stuff like that gets effectively truncated. So you might call this pixelation. There are different names for the effects of the quantization of the sensor array. And by the way, we usually like to use as low a resolution as we can, because it dramatically speeds up image processing. Now, the book mostly talks about spatial quantization. Probably your first computer assignment, I'm going to have you do spatial quantization as well as gray level quantization. And this is actually where it gets into what I was talking about earlier. Most sensors are 8 bits, but raw format and a number of other formats have gotten into using 16 bits. And what I mean by 16 bits is back here, when I said these are going between 0 and 255, that's based upon an 8-bit binary number representing each pixel. What if I had 16 bits available at each element? And that has some very, very interesting implications for dynamic range, etc. Okay. Just a little bit of talking about sensors. This is not a sensor course or a solid-state course, but this, for example, might be your typical solid-state sensor. We've got sensing elements right here, and I won't get into the electronics, but basically what happens is that photons create photoelectrons. Basically, they create charge, which gets captured by these wells. This is the actual image. The more light, the more photoelectrons produced, and basically, you accumulate them in those wells and read them out. And that's the way most of the sensors we're going to use work. I will comment on a couple things in ways that sensors are different, how they read out. And you can have stuff which reads out all in one direction, has an accumulator, and then that's clocked out. Okay, so you see what we're doing here is one entire line here, a vertical line, gets clocked over into this output register, and then that gets converted into serial output. And that's the way you're going to see most of your video signals. But for high-speed architectures and stuff, people do all kinds of different things. Sensors don't need to be square. It's quite common to have linear sensors. In fact, a source of very good, accurate, inexpensive sensors is to take apart a Xerox machine and get the sensors which measure the edges of paper. They're usually pretty good, and you might have 10, 24, or more sensors in a line. And those can be used in place of a square sensor, and they can be considerably faster if you can do one-dimensional image processing, like, for example, to find an edge of a piece of paper. And I won't get into any of this stuff. That there are different kinds of sensors out there, cameras. What the heck is that? Oh, a video camera. We're not going to get into all of that architecture. I always like to throw in the old RS-170 signals. You know, this is the old analog electronic video signal that's going away in 2 years. It will be replaced by the all-new digital stuff. But you have synchronization. This is your This is right here a horizontal line. And these pulse, technically, this is going to be your black level. As this goes up here, that's a brighter level. And so this would be what each line going across your television is showing. These are sync pulses, which are used to lock your oscillator. And it turns out that there is a relationship between the horizontals. And after you finish your 262 and a half of these, it flips back and comes back and fills in between them all in an interlaced scan with another 262 and a half. And there's all kinds of timing and stuff. Very elaborate analog. And it turns out they put color on top of this. And over here, there'll be a chroma burst. It was very interesting. They did it from the viewpoint originally of fitting the maximum amount of information into a color signal. And it uses phase modulation for the color and intensity modulation for plain old AM for the video level. And I'm not talking about the audio. That's an FM. So phase, FM, and intensity. We won't talk much more about cameras and stuff like that. You can see the architectures get pretty complicated. This is a medium that's almost going away. It's called film. Okay. Some people still use it, and they've gone from, obviously, the early silver, and actually what's really cool if you're an old photographer type, the platinum prints and all of that kind of stuff, but usually a light-sensitive material, whether it's an organic dye or something based on silver. And it turns out there are characteristics. I used to do holography and three-dimensional stuff, and this is the characteristic of, well, it's the HD curve for a film, and it shows what happens as you increase the exposure, what the optical density is. And we'll talk about optical density, but basically it's a measure of the relationship between the lightest and the darkest. In other words, the most transparent and the most opaque sections of a film. Okay, and notice that it's pretty linear over a long range. But down here, let's see, and I hope I don't have it backwards. Down here, you all you get is just light, and up here, you just get black. Actually, that's the other way around. Now, this will be related to some of your first assignments. And these are very classic things taken out of Ballard and Brown. And, you know, the original thing that everyone agreed about or talked about in image processing was how much resolution do we really need? You know, everyone's talking about 1080p, you want ultra-high resolution HD televisions. How much do you need for your task? Okay, and this is originally starting with a 1024 by 1024 image and stepping down in powers of 2. So this is 512 by 512, 256, 128, 64, 32. It actually looks off by a power of 2. It looks more like... Yeah, I think I'm off by a power of 2 there. But you can see what happens. And, you know, 1024, 512, there's not that much loss of information, at least as far as you and I can see in the image. You know, even over here at 256 or 128. And by the way we did it in stepping down, and we'll get into quad trees and stuff, is usually what we're doing is we're taking 4 pixels, averaging their intensity, and using that to translate into one over here. And there are all kinds of things, actually, which is really cool to get into, is we'll talk about topological connectivity of images. Here's another image. This is actually from some grad students at the University of Rochester. We just worked the other way. Just keep lowering the resolution. And you can see, yes, there can be a optimal below which you don't want to go. This shows now what happens when you deal with grayscale. Okay, 256 bits, full 8 bits. Or 256 gray levels corresponding to 8 bits of information. Start cutting off the bits one at a time. Okay, this is what we would call binary. It's 0 and 1. Okay, each pixel is either white or black. And you can go everywhere in between. And what's really interesting is if you're doing image processing, especially in things like, well, if you're into digital photography, this is one of the reasons why you're going to probably want to stick with 16-bit images, because you'll find that you get quantization effects in the color. When you start doing image processing operations. More grayscale resolution. You can tell, I think, it's probably from the 70s. There are some standard other images out there. These are old ones. You'll see these around. The mandrel here is very, very common. It's great. Look at the texture right there, all the little detail, and notice all the different colors. Plus, it looks cool. This is probably the most famous image in image processing, the Lena image. and you can find all kinds of stuff on here. It turns out that there's a whole thing about it. It turns out the original story is that this was done at USC, University of Southern California, their image processing lab, back in the 70s. They were writing a report that was due to the government. Okay, and this was on a Friday afternoon, and they needed some test images to process their, to use their image algorithms, image processing algorithms on, and they couldn't find anything that they had in their image library. So I guess a grad student had a copy of Playboy. They scanned a couple of the images, and she didn't even know that she had become one of the most famous test images in the image processing community. This is in almost every book. It's got, and look at it, it's got great color and texture here. Look at the differences in lighting here. This is actually a really great test image. Okay, and believe it or not, Playboy, after every image processing textbook included this image in it, decided to just give up and let everyone use it. Geometric transformations. Some people will call this image warping. We do this a lot. This is what happens if you tilt your camera. You get perspective. And it turns out, if you've really played with lenses and you get into high-precision stuff, lenses cause their own distortions. Okay? And you can do it for your own purpose, or you may want to get rid of it. So you can do all kinds of warping, stretching, pulling, etc. This is the MATLAB picture of image types. This is not the whole world of image files. And in fact, if you look at a program like Graphic Converter, which I tend to use on my Mac a lot, it accepts 170 different types of image file formats as input. And I think it supports 70 or 90 output formats. There are a lot of image formats out there. But what we do in MATLAB is, first of all, there will be, you can have just a general matrix of information. This is especially true when you're working with something that isn't an image originally. For example, you might create something from a numerical simulation. You might computer generate something which is nothing more than a matrix of numbers. Okay? That is your general matrix. Typically, you would convert that, and the routine is matte2 gray, into an intensity image. By intensity, I mean an ordinary black and white, not binary, but it has all of those gray levels in it. And, you know, this might even just be if you were doing some computer simulation, you would want to show the results of your data. Now, the other types are the binary. The binary is, instead of using the 8-bit representation, we use 1-bit. Okay, so it's just black or white. And there are a couple flavors of color out here, okay? And the most common one and the simplest one that most people understand is something called RGB, red, green, blue, and the reason is that we often have a red sensor, a green sensor, and a blue sensor. It's often accomplished by filters in front of the sensors. And from an awful lot of viewpoint, mathematically, etc., this is really pretty cool because we can physically think of them as layers and manipulate them. And you can see this with channel, color channels in Photoshop. And indexed color is a different way of representing color where instead of a coordinate for each, that is, 8 bits of red, 8 bits of green, and 8 bits of blue, we have a table of colors and an index to the table. And with certain types of images, that really shrinks down the size of the file needed to represent them. Now, histograms. These are going to be some of the images that are straight out of our textbook. And this is a very classic one. These are probably coffee beans. And you, and this is where you play around with Photoshop, and I don't, or similar things. And I don't know how many of you have tried to do things like adjust the brightness and the contrast of an image. Probably most of you have played with that at one point or another. And this is actually what's going on. What this is basically, I take a look at all of the pixels. And these are the latency going from 0 to 255, okay? And what I plot is simply how many pixels, that is, how many pixels have that particular intensity, okay? And so, for those of you who are a little more mathematically inclined, that represents the probability density function of the light value. So these are all very dark. You can see all of the pixels are located way down here near the black. Okay. No, fairly narrow. Okay. Now here's a bright image. Everything shifted up to the top. So a lot more white. A little dark black. Now, here's a low contrast image. You know, you all need to know what is the difference between brightness and contrast. Brightness is exactly where the pixels are in terms of intensity. Contrast refers to the width of the image. And if you look at this, they're all close together. Okay? And remember that earlier picture where I talked about something called histogram equalization? This is histogram equalization. What if I take that histogram right there, and I just grab it, stretch it out? And that's what I've done here. Notice I've stretched it out, and it looks like that. Okay, a lot of this same stuff is done in place. Anyway, histogram manipulation is both here. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You grab the little markers. We usually don't get the numbers, which is setting the middle point of the distribution. Okay. And there's all kinds that can go on. Anyone with the term chaos? And that is a mathematical variable. Okay. Or as a letter of whatever alphabet, but from the camera or optical or photography viewpoint. Okay. It turns out that the relationship between light level and the actual sensor output is usually not logarithmic or exponential. And that's where you get into these gammas. And those are the coefficients of the exponents. Okay. And you can do things, and you can also do these kind of transformations. These right now are called intensity transforms. Suppose I take that image, and at each element in it, what I do is I replace it with another value that's based only upon that value. So this is a one-to-one mapping. That's why we call it a point transformation. Okay. So here's image one, here's image two. This point will go to that point. This point will go to that point. They will not be dependent on anything else. So, for example, if this is the light level on the left, this would be the right the light level on the right. So we're simply changing grayscale to grayscale. Why might we do that? Well, that would stay for a funny sensor. If it's doing a log, we might want to do an exponential. Doing an exponential, we might want to do a log. And it turns out there's even more subtleties than just compensating for the detector, because people will get into it compensating light scattering as well. But usually it's compensating for an effect in either the film, the sensor, or some part of the system. And you'll see logs come up a lot. And by the way, as you vary the gammas, okay, one of the things that you can do, you know, normally, and in fact, you've seen all of those curves in there where you have straight lines and you can pull on them. and get all kinds of functions here. And this one, what's this one do? Well, this is how you make binary images. That's your threshold. Anything below that, okay, is going to remain. Anything above that is going to get light. So basically, we just make a binary image. Let's see. Aerial images. And this is applying a gamma, one of those point-to-point transformations. Aerial photograph, NASA, and you can see there's all kinds of scattering in the image due to clouds and haze and stuff. And yes, you can see real effects here. A lot of image processing is actually designed to simply make information in pictures more visible to people. Robots don't suffer from the same thing necessarily because they deal more mathematically with things. The histogram equalization that I told you about earlier, and there is the original histogram, and it turns out, and I'm not going to get into it now, but what you can do is if you tell me what histogram you want and what histogram I have, I can come up with a function to map from one to the other. And that's what some of this histogram equalization is all about. This one doesn't have a real high quantization, or doesn't have a really high resolution, so you can see a lot of the quantization that occurs when we stretch it. You know, there wasn't much up there. Okay, and just more histogram equalization. And by the way, this is the effect that you will see when you're working with 8-bit images in Photoshop and you're doing histogram equalization or you're modifying the gray level distribution somehow. And really, this is the effect of sampling. And that, you avoid this by going with your 32-bit, your raw format or whatever. You can do all kinds of stuff and improve the contrast and little things. There's image libraries out there, and this was, you know, there's your little arrows for setting your black and for setting your black and your white levels, and all kinds of programs out there. One of the things that you can do is black and white pseudo color it. Okay, pseudo color means, for example, I might take all levels between 245 and 255 and assign them one color. In other words, I'm going to have gray scales here, corresponding colors here. Actually, it doesn't need to be one-to-one. It's just to make it look good, highlight stuff, etc. And this was highlighting all values which have between 75 and 95 as grayscale value. And I'm not going to get into histogram specification here. This is where if you tell me what histogram you want, I can invert the function. And it turns out it's easy to do it numerically. Don't ask to do it analytically. Inverting functions is not really good mathematically unless you have very well-behaved functions. Okay. And this just shows the ways that you can construct it. And you can do nice things to make lunar pictures look better. Always a nice thing. And, of course, you can pay for your way through graduate school by doing image processing for weddings and things like that. And you can get into putting a mask on here and a halo effect. This is done by multiplying it by a Gaussian intensity distribution. Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, oh, I still have 3 minutes. There's room to fit stuff in. Okay. Spatial domain filtering. This is actually conceptually really quite simple in my mind. But you have to think about it. This is the original image. Okay? And image origin up here. What I'm going to do in what's called spatial image filtering, I'm going to take a mask. In this case, it's a 3x3. It's a very small image, if you want to think of it that way. And I'm going to move it here, okay? And I will multiply, and this shows it a little bit better. If this right here is the image, and this is the mask. For that position at which they're aligned, I'm going to multiply that by that, that one by that one, that one by that one. You see, I'm multiplying the corresponding elements together. Depending on what you're doing, I may then divide it by 9, which is the number of multiplications I did. In other words, I'm taking an average. Or I might not normalize it. In effect, it's a normalization. And the reason is, multiplying those, dividing, I'm going to put that new element in that pixel. You notice this is not a one-to-one. When I did one-to-one, here was an image here, that pixel mapped only into that one. That's when I was doing the point transformation. When I'm doing a spatial domain filter now, all of these values around it, and usually, by the way, the point we really use is the center, not the edge. Usually, that's our zero coordinate. Okay, and that'll get into interesting edge effects that we'll deal with later. Okay, but the reason for normalizing is, since the output is an image, and if I'm working with 8-bit images, I want to keep to the available range of my display device. In other words, I don't want to be creating 16-bit images necessarily from 8-bit images. You may want to, but in general, we don't. And I think I can get one more in. I always believe in giving you your money's worth, lecture-wise. Okay, and you can do all kinds of things, and this is actually very simple. Imagine now that all of the elements are one in this little mask that I slide around my image. Okay, I didn't tell you about sliding it, but imagine if here's my image, I put this mask on top of it, I multiply each element in the picture by ones, which means I'm summing them all up and dividing by the number of pixels. What did I just do? I averaged. So this is an averaging filter. And if you get into what does it mean in the frequency domain, it's a low-pass filter. But isn't this much easier to understand as an averaging filter than thinking about frequency domain stuff? Usually. Okay. Well, I'm going to stop there. Next time, I'm going to continue on this theme, get into the first two chapters of our textbook, and I'm going to keep working on refining that syllabus for the course. Because I may, after talking to Newman, I may want to move some of the motion stuff even earlier in the semester. And if you have any questions about the course, I'd be happy to talk to you about it. And let me turn the lights back on.